Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take a stack of sources and extract those crucial nuggets of knowledge, giving you a shortcut to being truly well-informed. I'm Lee Graham.
And I'm Sam Hurst. We're here to be your expert guides, helping you connect the dots and understand what truly matters in today's complex world.
Today, we're plunging into a rich collection of stories from a major news outlet. Our mission for this deep dive is to unpack the Washington Post for Tuesday, August 26, 2025.
It is a packed day. We're seeing everything from, you know, high-stakes political maneuvers and global conflicts.
Right, to the fascinating intersections of technology, culture, and sports. So let's unpack this and get to the heart of what's shaping our world. Let's dive right into the political pulse of the nation, because this past week has been, well, a whirlwind of executive actions. And at the heart of it all seems to be President Trump's fascinating and, let's say, somewhat controversial quest for something very specific. We're talking about the national and political landscape in the U.S., and specifically, President Trump's Nobel Peace Prize quest, ambition meets opposition.
It's quite a story, you're right. And it's not just a fleeting thought for him. It's truly been a through current of both his terms in office.
Really? Both terms?
Oh, yeah. And the effort has genuinely escalated recently. The president has openly mused that a Ukraine peace deal, something he's been actively working on, could be his key to the prize.
You said that publicly.
Openly. He's even gone so far as claiming credit for resolving six. And then by Friday, I think it was, up to 10 conflicts, including what he calls pre-wars.
Pre-wars? What does that even mean?
Well, that's a good question. It shows a deep-seated desire, though, for this particular international recognition.
So it's clearly a high priority. But beyond the public statements, what tangible steps has he actually taken? And crucially, how are those efforts being received by the committee members who, you know, actually make the decision?
Well, the sources show a clear pattern of effort. The pushes range from public comments to various world leaders to a more private initiative involving Norwegian Finance Minister Jens Stoltenberg.
Okay.
His Labour Party plays a role in influencing appointments to the Norwegian Nobel Committee. This committee, this critical electorate of five, ultimately makes the decision.
Right. Five people.
Exactly. What's particularly fascinating here, though, is that despite these efforts, at least three of these five Norwegian deciders have publicly criticized the president.
Three out of five. Wow. That's a significant hurdle, especially if they're being so vocal. Were there specific criticisms they leveled against him?
Absolutely. The committee chairman, Jorgen Watne-Friednes, was quite explicit back in December. He spoke out against the erosion of freedom of expression, even in democratic nations, pointing directly to President Trump's more than 100 verbal attacks on the media during his election campaign.
Okay, so freedom of expression, attacks on media.
Yes. And Finess, he also heads PE Norway, which is an organization dedicated to promoting freedom of expression, so it's core to his beliefs. He offered a very poignant observation about awarding the prize to heads of state.
Oh.
He noted they often have blood on your hands if it's a conflict, yet they also possess the power to do things afterwards. That dual reality, of course, complicates the picture significantly.
Blood on your hands is...
Yeah.
Yeah, that's certainly a strong phrase. Makes it pretty clear where he stands.
It does.
So given this very vocal opposition from key decision makers, what does this realistically mean for his chances, particularly for 2025?
Well, based on the sources, the 2025 award seems highly unlikely for President Trump.
Okay.
The official cutoff for nominations was way back in January, so that window has closed for this year.
Right.
However, this doesn't mean the ambition is, you know, dead. Some Norwegians are already suggesting that 2026 could be a possibility if these Ukraine peace efforts continue. So it hints at a potential long game.
2026, maybe?
Maybe. The key insight here, I think, is that personal ambition, especially for such a globally recognized award, can indeed create powerful, sometimes distorting incentives for a leader's foreign policy agenda. It could potentially even override other strategic considerations.
That's a powerful implication, that the pursuit of personal recognition could actually influence global strategies.
Certainly something we'll consider.
And speaking of the president wielding power, his domestic approach seems to be taking an equally strong stance, particularly on law and order.
Mm-hmm.
What are we seeing with his executive actions targeting ending cashless bail and criminalizing flag burning?
Exactly. The president signed two executive orders aimed squarely at these issues, both deeply important to his conservative base. Let's break down the cashless bail initiative first.
Okay.
Specifically for Washington, D.C., these orders demand that law enforcement pursue pretrial detention whenever possible, and they even threaten to withhold federal money and services if the city continues its cashless bail system.
Wow, withholding funds.
Yes. The president frames this as a vital public safety measure. He claims D.C. was once the most dangerous place, but is now probably the safest, thanks to his interventions.
But D.C. itself, I mean, they seem to have a very different perspective on its bail system and crime rates, don't they? What's the city's counter-narrative?
They significantly challenge that narrative. D.C. actually banned cash bonds way back in the 1990s.
The 90s, I think.
Yeah. And more recently, in 2023 and 2024, they expanded pretrial detention for violent crimes, a move Mayor Muriel Bowser credits for a recent decline in shootings and homicides.
So they're saying their policies are working.
Precisely. And furthermore, data from the Brennan Center's Justice Program, they're a nonpartisan law and policy organization, they analyzed 33 cities and found no statistically significant relationship between bail reform and crime trends.
Interesting.
And DC's own pretrial services agency also reports high court appearance rates and low reoffending rates for those released pretrial. Something like 87% of defendants were released pretrial in fiscal 2024, and 89% of those were not rearrested while awaiting trial.
So the city is presenting a very data-driven defense of its system. It sounds like a clear clash between that data and the political framing.
It really does. Critics, including D.C. Attorney General Brian L. Schwalb, are calling these orders blatant federal overreach.
Overreach.
Yes, arguing they disregard effective, data-driven policies purely for political purposes. They also point out the policy disproportionately impacts Black communities, perpetuating a two-tiered system of justice.
And is the administration using any leverage here?
They are apparently using federal approvals, like for the RFK Stadium site, as leverage to compel D.C. to reinstate cash bail.
Hmm. And then there's the other executive order on flag burning. This seems to directly challenge established legal precedent, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. This order directs prosecution for flag desecration. It even calls for the detention and removal of immigrants accused of such acts.
Detention and removal for flag burning.
That's what the order states. And it directly confronts the 1989 Supreme Court ruling, Texas v. Johnson, which protected flag burning under the First Amendment as symbolic speech.
So he's tasking the AG to challenge that?
Yes. The president has tasked Attorney General Pam Bondi to find a case to challenge this, clearly hoping the current conservative court might overturn that precedent.
What's the administration's justification for such a direct challenge to the First Amendment?
Well, a White House official cited images of flag burning alongside violent acts during recent protests, specifically mentioned Los Angeles, where some Mexican flags were apparently displayed alongside burning American flags.
Okay.
The president himself, who is known to be very attuned to visual imagery, reportedly took great issue with these scenes. However, groups like Fire the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression have condemned the order.
Unsurprisingly.
They call it a clear violation of the First Amendment, asserting that expression, even unpopular expression, is protected speech. The key takeaway here seems to be that these executive orders represent a concerted effort to assert federal authority over local governance and individual expression. They're deliberately testing constitutional boundaries and judicial precedents to align policy with a specific political ideology.
That's a lot of potential legal battles on the horizon. And this intense focus on law and order, it seems to extend even to personal political rivals,
mm-hmm.
as we're seeing with the president's actions towards former Governor Chris Christie. It really feels like retribution as policy in this instance.
That's precisely the perception many sources are highlighting. The president's threat of a new investigation into Christie over the years-old Bridgegate scandal. It was directly triggered by Christie's recent television appearance.
What did Christie say?
He criticized the president's alleged politicization of the Justice Department.
So it's a direct, swift response to criticism. What exactly did the president say or post?
The president's social media posts accused Christie of refusing to take responsibility for these criminal acts and declared, "No one is above the law." Then in the Oval Office, he reportedly referred to Christie as a slob.
Wow.
And indicated his Justice Department could revisit the issue, despite adding that his administration had other things to do.
This is quite a reversal from his previous stance on Bridgegate, isn't it? I seem to recall him supporting Christie during that time.
It's an almost complete reversal. Christie was an early supporter of the president, remember? But then he became a vocal critic and a 2024 Republican primary rival.
Right, the rivalry.
And ironically, the president had previously congratulated Christie on a complete and total exoneration when the Supreme Court overturned convictions of Christie's aides. He dismissed the scandal back then as an Obama DOJ scam.
And now?
Now, his current stance is quite different. I always felt he was guilty, he stated recently.
I always felt he was guilty after congratulating him on exoneration.
Exactly. The insight here, I think, is that the episode with Chris Christie reveals a clear pattern. The president's public and private statements suggest a willingness to leverage the machinery of justice for political retribution. This raises serious questions about the independence of legal institutions and sets a potentially dangerous precedent for future administrations.
It certainly makes you wonder about the long-term impact on our legal system and this pattern of executive power, maybe even retribution. It certainly doesn't stop with political figures.
No.
We see it playing out in some profound ways with the administration's approach to immigration, particularly in a case like the Kilmar-Briggo-Garcia deportation battle, where due process seems genuinely on the line.
This case is a profound and, frankly, highly visible symbol of the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement. Kilmar Abrego-Garcia was detained by ICE Immigration and Customs Enforcement in Baltimore mere days after his release from criminal custody.
Okay.
This swift action was part of the administration's plan to deport him to Uganda, potentially before he even faces trial on human smuggling charges in Tennessee.
Uganda. That seems specific. And I understand there's a history with this case involving a judge stepping in previously.
Yes. Federal Judge Paula Sinas has again intervened. She temporarily barred his removal to Uganda until a hearing can ensure his due process rights are fully protected.
Okay, so the judge stepped in again.
This isn't the first time. Judge Sinas previously ordered his return after the government mistakenly deported him to a mega prison for gang members in El Salvador.
Mistakenly deported him.
Wow.
That's what happened. Administration officials had explicitly insisted Abrego would never go free in the U.S. and openly criticized the judge's earlier ruling that he wasn't a flight risk.
So a clear pattern of executive action clashing with judicial oversight. What are the legal teams saying about the administration's intent here? Why Uganda?
Abrego's lawyers assert that the government is strategically using Uganda as a stick and Costa Rica, a Spanish-speaking country, regarded as safe as a carrot.
A stick and a carrot.
To coerce a guilty plea to human smuggling charges, they state that plea negotiations were nearly concluded, with Abrego's team requesting a Spanish-speaking third country for his removal. Prosecutors, however, call this claim misleading, maintaining that plea negotiations were undertaken in good faith.
This case has also been heavily politicized, hasn't it? With public figures making strong, sometimes inflammatory statements.
It has become a real lightning rod. Dozens of activists rallied for Abrego in Baltimore, holding signs like, "Free Kilmar." Simultaneously, high-ranking officials President Trump, Attorney General Pam Bondi, Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem have publicly labeled Abrego an animal, an MS-13 gang member, human trafficker, and child predator.
Those are incredibly strong accusations.
They are. And what's crucial to understand is that many of these accusations are unproven or, in some cases, entirely uncharged in court. Abrego's lawyers and family have denied he's a gang member, and he has not been charged with child sex abuse offenses.
The legal implications must be significant if high-ranking officials are making unproven accusations during an ongoing case like this.
They are profoundly significant. Abrego's legal team has filed a new lawsuit to block his deportation to Uganda, push for Costa Rica instead, and declare his detention unlawful. He's also requested an asylum interview, citing fears of persecution in Uganda and a prior beating he suffered when mistakenly deported to El Salvador.
He'd already won protection from deportation to El Salvador?
Yes, back in 2019, due to gang threats. While prosecutors in his criminal case in Tennessee allege he is an MS-13 gang leader and a prolific smuggler, his attorneys call this prosecution vindictive and selective, arguing it's basically punishment for challenging his earlier removal.
And his trial is still pending.
His trial is set for January. But if ICD deports him first, those charges would likely just be dropped. The core insight emerging from this case, I think, is that the Trump administration's aggressive immigration enforcement tactics, coupled with inflammatory public rhetoric by high-ranking officials, increasingly threaten to undermine the fundamental principles of due process and judicial independence in the U.S. legal system.
It's a stark example of the power dynamics at play. Another significant development in immigration policy is the widening ban on in-state tuition for non-citizens. This puts education and economic futures at risk for many, many students.
Yes, this policy is poised to create immense uncertainty and dramatically higher tuition bills for tens of thousands of undocumented students in Texas public colleges. And what's concerning, the Justice Department is actively seeking to replicate this ban in other states.
So Texas is just the start.
Potentially. This effectively upends the Texas Dream Act of 2001. And that act, notably, had broad bipartisan support and even survived under deeply red state leadership.
Right. I remember Governor Perry's quote.
Exactly. Former Governor Rick Perry, a Republican, famously said, "If you say that we should not educate children who come into our state for no other reason than that they've been brought there through no fault of their own, I don't think you have a heart." That quote really highlights the significant shift in perspective we're seeing now.
It absolutely does.
Yeah.
How did this change come about so rapidly in Texas?
Well, the change came after a Justice Department lawsuit this summer. The DOJ argued that federal law preempts or overrides state benefits if U.S. citizens have to pay out of state rates.
Okay, the federal preemption argument.
Essentially, the federal government is saying states cannot give non-citizens a benefit, like in-state tuition, that isn't equally extended to all U.S. citizens, even those from other states. The lawsuit was settled remarkably quickly within 6 hours.
6 hours?
Yes, leading critics to allege legal cahoots between the administration and state officials. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi explicitly stated that the Justice Department would relentlessly fight to vindicate federal law and ensure that U.S. citizens are not treated like second-class citizens.
What's the financial impact for these students? It sounds like it could be devastating.
It is staggering. Tuition could triple overnight. For instance, at the University of Texas at Austin, in-state tuition is around $13,500 annually. Out of state, it can exceed $46,000.
$46,000? That's impossible for many.
Absolutely. Oscar Silva, a 24-year-old student from Dallas, brought from Mexico as an infant, he embodies this struggle. He's now part of a group challenging this deal. And the national ripple effect is concerning, too. Similar lawsuits have been filed against Kentucky, Minnesota, and Oklahoma, threatening policies in 23 states, plus D.C., that currently grant in-state tuition to undocumented students.
23 states and D.C.
Wow. And beyond the direct financial hit, what are the broader economic and social costs here?
Immigrant advocates warn that Texas alone could lose over $461 million in annual economic activity just from lost wages and diminished spending power if these students can't afford to finish their education.
$460 million just in Texas.
Just in Texas annually. The uncertainty even impacts DACA students who are considered lawfully present. Some schools are reportedly illegally blocking their lower rates, highlighting a lack of clear guidance, and effectively forcing institutions to act like immigration officers.
So it's creating chaos for the schools, too. It is. According to Thomas Sains of MELDEF, that's the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, this policy is a deliberate legal strategy by the administration to test different elements and push the Supreme Court to take up the issue. But beyond the legal precedent, the clear intent, he says, is to scare people, making life more difficult for people. The core insight here is that this policy is a deliberate legal strategy by the administration, using federal law to override state decisions and scare people, ultimately creating long-term detrimental consequences for higher education access, social mobility, and the economic integration of these individuals into society across multiple states.
These hardline immigration policies are definitely creating division. And it sounds like there's a significant internal debate now within the Democratic Party about how to respond.
Yes.
This brings us to reforming Democratic immigration stances and their search for a new middle ground.
That's a truly crucial development for the Democratic Party. The New Democrat Coalition, a group of 115 House Democrats, so a pretty significant bloc, has unveiled a comprehensive framework for immigration reform. Okay. Their explicit aim is twofold. Regain voter credibility on the issue, and, crucially, unify the party after some recent electoral losses where immigration was a key factor.
So they're trying to bridge a very clear ideological gap within their own party. What exactly does that divide look like, and how are they proposing to bridge it?
Historically, yeah, the party's been divided. You have liberals focusing heavily on citizenship pathways, protections for immigrants. Then you have moderates emphasizing border enforcement and security measures first and foremost.
A classic tension.
Exactly. Representative Gabe Vasquez, who spearheaded this new effort, he openly acknowledges that the American people have lost faith in the Democratic Party when it comes to border security. This framework is a direct attempt to bridge that gap. by addressing both concerns simultaneously.
And what's the evidence that this approach might actually be an opportunity for Democrats to make gains? Is there polling or recent election data?
Well, recent polls show Republicans still have a significant advantage on immigration generally. But importantly, President Trump's disapproval on the issue is rising.
Oh, interesting.
Which creates an opportunity, as the Democrats see it, to reclaim the narrative. We also saw in the 2024 elections that moderates like Representatives Tom Suozzi and Larry Gillen won tough races by adopting stricter border security messages.
Like what, specifically?
Things like deporting criminals and even temporarily closing the border to asylum seekers. This contrasted somewhat with the Harris campaign's more balanced approach, suggesting a shift in voter sentiment that these Democrats are trying to tap into.
So a shift in messaging for some Democrats seems to have yielded results. What are the key proposals in this new framework, particularly from an economic lens? You mentioned that linkage.
Yes, the framework explicitly links border security and immigration to economic effects, recognizing the economy is a top issue for voters. It proposes several things. New temporary non-immigrant visas for industries facing critical shortages, think agriculture, hospitality.
Okay, targeted visas. Right, a new caregiver visa to support growing demand. 100,000 additional green cards, specifically for international U.S. university graduates in STEM fields, for instance, and a special visa program for immigrant startups, all aiming to incentivize innovation, benefit the economy, and shore up national security. It's a very deliberately economic framing.
And beyond the economic aspect, what about proposals for border security and due process or the status of undocumented migrants already in the U.S.?
On border security, it calls for adequate DHS funding Department of Homeland Security, specifically for 22,000 Border Patrol agents, raises for lower paid agents, and crucial technology upgrades along the border.
So more resources for enforcement.
Yes, but it also advocates for detaining and deporting non-citizens with felonies while crucially reestablishing due process in those matters. So enforcement plus due process.
Okay, that's an important distinction.
And for migrants already in the U.S. without authorization, it proposes legal pathways for official status and, in some cases, citizenship, but only for those who meet specific criteria and have no criminal records. This also aims to address concerns about benefits offered to asylum seekers versus legal immigrants seeking a more consistent approach. The insight here, really, is that the new Democrat coalition's immigration framework represents a strategic pivot for the Democratic Party. They're attempting to unify diverse ideological wings by explicitly reframing immigration as an economic issue tied to national security, a move clearly aimed at regaining voter trust and positioning the party for future electoral success, especially in those swing districts.
This comprehensive approach to national and political issues inevitably intertwines with the economic and business environment, where the administration is also making significant waves.
Absolutely.
Let's shift our focus to economic and business headwinds. Starting with President Trump's economic interventions and consequences. A major point of discussion, and frankly quite startling, is the attempt to fire Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook. This seems like a direct threat to central bank independence.
This is unprecedented and, yes, deeply concerning to many economists and observers. President Trump has directly moved to oust Federal Reserve Governor Lisa Cook over what he calls unproven allegations of mortgage fraud.
Mortgage fraud. What are the specifics?
He's accusing her of describing two properties as her primary residence back in 2021. He actually posted a letter on social media citing his authority to remove Fed governors for cause, which means malfeasance or dereliction of duty.
And what has been Governor Cook's response to this pretty direct attack?
Cook, who is the first Black woman on the Fed board, has strongly disputed the president's authority. She's refused to resign and has hired an outside attorney. She stated unequivocally, "President Trump purported to fire me for cause when no cause exists under the law and he has no authority to do so." This is significant because, as you said, the Federal Reserve is fundamentally designed to operate independently of the White House to maintain financial stability.
Right, that independence is key. What are the broader implications of such an action? Critics must be weighing in heavily on this.
The criticism is indeed strong and widespread. Michael Strain, who's at the Conservative American Enterprise Institute, called it extremely dangerous and is, in the case of the Fed, a threat to long-term prosperity.
Extremely dangerous.
Yes. And Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts, labeled it an authoritarian power grab that blatantly violates the Federal Reserve Act and insisted it must be overturned in court.
What's driving the president's motivation for this, do you think, beyond the specific allegations against Cook? Is there a bigger picture?
Well, this move is widely seen as a direct attempt to exert control over the independent body and achieve his long-standing goal of lowering interest rates.
Ah, the interest rates.
Exactly. He has previously pressured Fed Chair Jerome H. Powell, even nicknaming him too late to cut rates, saying he wants them 2 or 3 percentage points lower.
Right, I remember that.
And no president has ever sought to oust a sitting Fed governor before, ever, which makes this an extraordinary challenge to the Fed's independence. It also, disturbingly, follows a pattern of the Trump administration leaning on personal mortgage data to target perceived political adversaries.
That pattern is concerning.
It is. The core insight here is that the attempt to remove a Federal Reserve governor sets a dangerous precedent. It demonstrates a direct challenge to the central bank's independence and signals a willingness to interfere with economic institutions to achieve specific political objectives. This could fundamentally destabilize market confidence and the predictability of U.S. economic policy.
That's a huge potential disruption to economic stability, absolutely.
Yeah.
The administration's willingness to intervene doesn't stop at the central bank, though.
No.
It extends directly into private enterprise, as we're seeing with the government's stake in Intel. This is also quite unusual.
Highly unusual. And somewhat alarming to many in the business community. Intel recently warned in an SEC filing, that's the Securities and Exchange Commission, that the Trump administration's 10% stake in the chipmaker poses significant risks to its business.
What kind of risks?
Things like jeopardizing international sales, damaging its standing with various stakeholders, customers, partners, foreign governments, and alarmingly, the White House has indicated it may pursue similar tie-ups with other strategically important companies.
A 10% government stake in a major tech company like Intel. That sounds completely unprecedented. How was this deal framed by the administration and what are the critics saying?
The administration presented the deal as a way of essentially clawing back billions in federal grants previously given to Intel under the Chip PS Act.
Okay, so a justification based on recouping funds.
Right. But critics are calling it an unprecedented intrusion into private enterprise. Senator Rand Paul, a Republican from Kentucky, called it a terrible idea. California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, went further, suggesting that under the president, the U.S. is becoming the Socialist Republic of America.
Strong words.
Very. Editorial boards and other opinion writers have widely condemned the deal as a mistake and antithetical to American greatness, arguing it's a dangerous government overreach.
What are Intel's specific concerns about this government ownership? You mentioned international sales.
Yes, Intel derives 3/4 of its revenue from international sales. The company fears these sales could suffer significantly due to the government stake.
Why? Because foreign governments might see it as U.S. government interference?
Potentially, yes. Or that decisions might be politically motivated rather than purely business-driven. They anticipate potential litigation and backlash from foreign governments and business partners. Their SEC filing candidly noted that it's difficult to foresee all the potential consequences.
And will this even help Intel? Critics seem skeptical.
Many critics argue this deal is unlikely to fix Intel's deep-seated problems anyway. The company has been lagging in smartphone and AI markets, and its manufacturing is behind TSMC, the Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company, a global leader. The core insight here seems to be that while framed as promoting national interest and competitiveness, direct government intervention in private enterprise, like taking an equity stake in Intel, risks stifling market innovation, introducing political favoritism, and ultimately undermining, rather than strengthening, long-term U.S. technological leadership and free market principles. It raises huge questions about industrial policy.
Those are weighty questions for the future of American industry, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And this spirit of intervention and competition is also palpable in international trade, with direct impacts on global supply chains and local economies.
Mm-hmm.
Let's turn our attention to the impact of trade wars and economic policy, specifically how India's diamond capital is losing its sheen. This sounds like a very human story.
This is a powerful human story, yes. It illustrates the direct, often painful consequences of trade policy. Surat, India, which traditionally cuts and polishes nearly every diamond sold globally, is experiencing what's described as a near standstill.
Why?
Due to the president's escalating tariffs on India, which are set to climb to 50%.
50% tariffs on diamonds? That sounds like an enormous impact. What does this mean for the people working in the diamond industry there?
The human impact is immediate and severe. We read about Ajay Lakum, a 35-year-old diamond sorter who was laid off. This directly impacts his 10-person household and, tragically, his mother's cancer treatments.
Oh, terrible.
Union leaders estimate that 50,000 workers have been laid off since April, with projections of up to 100,000 if tariffs actually reach that 50% mark.
100,000 people potentially losing their jobs.
And ancillary businesses, tobacco sellers, lunch stalls, you name it. They're also seeing steep declines. It creates a ripple effect through the entire local economy. Vallabh Rathod, a diamond polishing company co-owner, has had to halve his workforce and seen his personal income plummet from around $690 to $285 a month. The ordinarily humming Kohinoor Road, the main diamond market street, is now described as eerily calm.
That's devastating for a whole community. How is the Indian government responding to this crisis impacting its citizens? Is there support?
Well, interestingly, while Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi actually hails from Gujarat, the state where Surat is located, his government has reportedly prioritized other industries like seafood and agriculture and trade negotiations, leaving diamond workers feeling largely ignored.
Really? Ignored.
That's the feeling reported. Modi's government has signaled a strengthening of ties with the BRICS bloc. That's Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and has expressed readiness to pay a heavy price to protect India's economy from what they consider an unfair trade deal with the U.S.
So a geopolitical shift potentially driven by these tariffs.
It could be part of it. Analysts warn that with thin margins already, plus increased costs from sanctions on Russian diamonds, these tariffs could force a significant downsizing of the industry. The core insight here is that escalating trade wars and tariffs, while aimed at geopolitical leverage, often result in severe and immediate human and economic costs, leading to widespread job losses, community instability, and a reshaping of global supply chains that can even shift political allegiances at a local level. We read about one diamond sorter, Bhavesh Bakar, who now blames Modi and says he won't vote for him again because of this.
It's a vivid illustration of how global policy translates to individual hardship and political sentiment.
Yeah.
While tariffs create economic pain, other policy areas show a struggle perhaps to keep up with innovation or effectively implement large-scale programs.
Right.
Let's look at the future of home building and bridging the digital divide. Two seemingly separate issues, but maybe linked by policy challenges.
We're seeing two distinct but related challenges here for the U.S., yes. First, in home building, our sources indicate the U.S. is actually behind in the future of home building.
Behind? How so?
Largely due to the Trump administration's cuts to grants for materials development research into new materials that could significantly reduce construction costs. Meanwhile, China is strategically focusing on technological leadership in new materials with its massive $300 billion Made in China 2025 industrial plan.
So China's investing heavily where the U.S. cut funding.
Exactly. China already produces over half of the world's cement, leads in bio-based chemicals, and controls most rare earth elements needed for advanced materials. American alternatives, by contrast, remain trapped in laboratory settings without the ability to demonstrate their viability at scale.
That sounds like a serious strategic disadvantage.
It's described as a strategic inflection point where the U.S. must choose to lead or essentially end up licensing these crucial technologies from China in the future.
Okay, that's home building. What about bridging the digital divide? We've heard a lot about federal programs aimed at getting broadband everywhere.
Yes, the $42 billion Broadband Equity Access and Deployment Program, the BEAD program enacted back in 2021, aimed to close the digital divide across the country. Huge program.
$42 billion.
Huge. However, it has become mired in bureaucracy with lengthy administrative processes and shifting eligibility rules. Progress has been incredibly slow.
So government bureaucracy slowing things down. What's surprising here?
What's surprising, or maybe ironic, is that while BEAD faced these delays, the private sector dramatically expanded high-speed access. Telecom companies reached millions of new homes and reduced the number of unserved households by 65%.
65% reduction by the private sector.
Yes, all without a single BEAD-funded project actually coming online yet. And this private sector expansion occurred even as average internet bills stayed flat or even fell, which contrasts sharply with heavily regulated sectors like electricity, where prices actually rose.
So the private sector unexpectedly outpaced the massive government program. What are the policy recommendations coming out of this observation?
Well, experts are now arguing that BEAD should act as a supplement to the market, not try to reshape it. Basically, plug the remaining holes efficiently.
Target the truly unserved areas.
Exactly. Target funding to truly unserved areas, avoid subsidies for unproven providers, and rethink expensive government-owned networks that often risk debt and mismanagement. It's also critical, they say, to ensure affordability for low-income families, especially with the lapse of the Affordable Connectivity Program back in May 2024.
Right, the ACP ending was a big deal.
It was. The overall insight from these two areas, home building materials and broadband, is that the U.S. faces a critical challenge in effectively integrating innovation and infrastructure into national policy. Government intervention, while potentially well-intentioned, can struggle with bureaucratic inefficiencies and risk stifling private sector initiatives, leading to missed opportunities for technological leadership and equitable access.
These are vital questions for our long-term competitiveness and equity. From economic policies to geopolitical maneuvers, the threads of global and national events are often intertwined, sometimes with deadly consequences.
Sadly, yes.
Let's move to global conflicts and humanitarian concerns, and the unfolding crises we're seeing. First, the tragic Israeli attack on Gaza Hospital, which highlights potential war crimes and the cost to truth.
This is indeed a deeply disturbing and profoundly serious event. An Israeli attack on Gaza's Nasser Hospital killed at least 20 people. This included 5 journalists and medics killed in 2 strikes just minutes apart on August 25th.
2 strikes minutes apart on the same building.
Yes. Footage shows 2 distinct strikes hitting the same building. Journalists and rescue workers were actually rushing to the scene after the first strike when the second one hit.
Oh my goodness. And what has been the Israeli response to this attack on a hospital, which is supposed to be protected?
The Israel Defense Forces, the IDF, issued a statement expressing regret and denying targeting journalists. They also stated an investigation is underway.
It's okay, an investigation.
However, this incident occurs in the chilling context of Israel having killed, according to reports, scores of journalists in Gaza since October 7, 2023, and they've banned foreign media from entering Gaza independently.
Right, leaving Palestinian journalists basically alone to cover it.
Exactly, which makes their already dangerous work even more critical and, frankly, perilous.
Can you give us more details on the victims and the specifics of the attack itself? Who were these journalists?
Among the dead were Maram Daga, she was a freelancer for the Associated Press, Hussam Al-Masri, a Reuters contract photographer, Mohammed Salama, an Al Jazeera cameraman, and 2 freelance reporters, Moaz Abu Taha and Ahmed Abu Aziz.
So, multiple news organizations affected?
Yes. Witnesses confirmed that the targeted staircase was a well-known spot for the press corps to get cell service. Apparently, Al-Masri often broadcast live from there. One photographer even noted a drone hovering between the first and second strikes, which happened about 7 minutes apart.
A drone hovering. That adds another layer of concern about potential targeting, doesn't it?
It certainly does.
Under international law, what are the implications of an attack on a hospital, especially with successive strikes like this double tap?
Britain, Germany, and the United Nations have all condemned these strikes. Adil Hoke, he's an expert on the law of armed conflict at Rutgers University, states unequivocally that an attack on a hospital is illegal unless very stringent conditions are met.
Like what?
Like the facility being actively used to harm the enemy, a warning being ignored, and all feasible precautions being taken to minimize harm to civilians. He noted that none of these conditions appear to have been fulfilled in this instance. And he specifically emphasized that double-tap strikes in populated areas are rarely lawful.
Rarely lawful.
Beyond the journalists, 4 hospital staff and a medical student were killed. An operating room was partially damaged, a firefighter was killed trying to evacuate people, and rescue vehicles were taken out of service. The toll was significant.
Just devastating.
Thibo Broton of Reporters Without Borders asked, how far will the Israeli armed forces go in their gradual effort to eliminate information coming from Gaza? The core insight here is that the attack on Nasser Hospital, occurring amidst a pattern of journalist casualties and restricted media access, raises profound concerns about potential war crimes and underscores what some see as a deliberate effort to control the narrative of conflict, severely impacting freedom of the press and humanitarian efforts under international law.
It's a stark reminder of the human cost of conflict and the critical importance of independent reporting. This tragic event isn't the only international incident drawing diplomatic fire and highlighting rising tensions, though.
No.
We also have France summoning U.S. Ambassador Charles Kushner due to a diplomatic spat over anti-Semitism and foreign policy.
This was a direct and highly unusual diplomatic move, yes. France's foreign ministry formally summoned U.S. Ambassador Charles Kushner after he published an open letter in the Wall Street Journal.
An open letter from an ambassador.
Yeah.
What did it accuse the French government of?
He accused the French government of not doing enough to halt rising anti-Semitism in the country.
Okay. What specifically did Ambassador Kushner say in his letter that prompted such a strong reaction?
Well, he asserted that anti-Semitic assaults had exploded since Hamas's October 7th, 2023 attack. And then he controversially suggested that President Emmanuel Macron's criticism of Israel and France's move toward recognizing a Palestinian state had actually emboldened anti-Semitic sentiments.
So linking French foreign policy criticism of Israel to anti-Semitism within France.
Exactly. Kushner, who is the son of Holocaust survivors and, of course, the father of Jared Kushner, urged France to adopt a serious plan to address the issue.
And how did France officially respond to these remarks from a U.S. ambassador? It seems like interference.
France swiftly rejected his remarks as unacceptable. They considered them interference in domestic affairs and a clear breach of diplomatic norms. They highlighted their own total mobilization against anti-Semitism, noting that 1,570 acts were reported last year. That figure is lower than 2023, but still far higher than pre-2023 levels. This was amidst a broader 11% increase in racist crimes overall in France. So they essentially said their commitment and actions were already robust.
This sounds like it's part of deeper underlying tensions between the two countries, particularly over foreign policy, maybe specifically the Middle East.
It definitely seems to be. This diplomatic row underscores the souring ties between Paris and Washington, particularly over their increasingly conflicting stances on Israel's war in Gaza.
How have their stances diverged?
France, traditionally a longtime Israeli ally, has become much more critical of Israel's actions recently, and they plan to recognize a Palestinian state in September.
Recognize Palestine in September, that's a big step.
It is, and it drew condemnation from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and also from U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who called it Hamas propaganda.
So a clear split.
A clear split. What's also notable, adding another layer, is Ambassador Kushner's own background. He was confirmed by a narrow Senate vote, and he was previously imprisoned back in 2005 for tax evasion, witness tampering, and illegal campaign contributions. He was later pardoned by President Trump in 2020.
Right. That history adds complexity.
It does. The core insight from this incident seems to be that personal histories and strongly held beliefs, especially when interwoven with family connections to influential figures, can profoundly influence diplomatic actions, leading to highly public disputes and potentially fracturing longstanding alliances over critical foreign policy issues in an increasingly polarized global environment.
That's a fascinating point about how personal histories can play into international relations. And speaking of unpredictability, the president's approach to international relations is, well, equally unpredictable.
Often, yes.
As seen in his recent meeting with the South Korean leader. Let's delve into Trump meeting with the South Korean leader after a public threat.
This meeting really showcased that unpredictable nature of the president's diplomatic style. He hosted South Korean President Lee Jae-myung at the White House just hours after making an ominous social media post threatening to withhold U.S. business from South Korea.
Hours after a threat. What was the nature of that public threat? It sounds quite strong.
It was. The president's Truth Social post questioned, "What is going on in South Korea? Seems like a purge or revolution," adding, "We can't have that and do business there."
Purge or revolution? What was he referring to?
He later explained this was in reference to very vicious raids on churches, though it was unclear what he was specifically referring to, possibly a corruption investigation into the Unification Church, but it wasn't clear.
So he made this public accusation potentially based on unclear information, but how did the actual meeting play out in the Oval Office? Mm-hmm. Was it as confrontational as the social media post suggested?
Surprisingly, no. Not at all, according to reports. Despite the pre-meeting rhetoric, the president apparently downplayed the raids during their Oval Office meeting, calling it a misunderstanding and expressing warmth toward South Korea.
A misunderstanding, okay.
And President Lee, in turn, complimented the president's Oval Office redecorating and his peacemaking efforts. He even jokingly suggested building a Trump Tower in North Korea and playing golf with Kim Jong-un.
Golf with Kim Jong-un. Okay, so it sounds like they found some common ground despite the initial public bluster. Were there any shared experiences or alignments between the two leaders?
They do share some unusual political experiences, actually. Both leaders survived assassination attempts during events last year.
Both of them? Wow.
Yes, and both saw their careers arguably boosted by criminal indictments they faced. They also seem to align on the desire to jumpstart diplomacy with North Korea's Kim Jong-un.
But I'm sure there are still thorny issues beneath that cordial surface, right?
Mm-hmm.
Alliances aren't built on jokes about golf.
Absolutely. Thorny issues remain. Like the potential removal of U.S. troops from South Korea, the president incorrectly stated there were 40,000 troops. The actual number is 28,500.
Okay, troop levels.
Also, Seoul's share of defense spending a perennial issue and ongoing tariff negotiations. Plus, President Lee's policy of strategic flexibility, which means seeking closer ties with China, could create a rift with the president's America First strategy.
Yeah, that could definitely clash.
And one other point. The president also expressed a desire to own rather than simply lease the land for a massive military base in South Korea.
Own the land. That's unusual for overseas bases.
Very. The insight here is that the president's unpredictable diplomatic style, characterized by public threats followed by cordial private meetings, introduces significant instability into U.S. alliances, particularly in volatile regions like East Asia, and makes long-term regional security and trade relationships difficult to predict or plan for.
The unpredictability is certainly a constant theme. Beyond these high-profile diplomatic events, another critical international struggle is unfolding, this time in the digital realm, maybe largely unnoticed by the wider public.
Mm.
That brings us to internet freedom programs in Iran imperiled, which speaks to the silencing of dissent.
This is a significant and, frankly, escalating concern for human rights advocates and those monitoring the digital landscape. The U.S. State Department has not signed off on new funding for programs that help Iranian citizens evade government internet censorship.
So programs helping Iranians bypass censorship are losing funding.
Potentially, yes. The funding is stalled. This potentially cripples a bipartisan policy that actually aligns with the Trump administration's own stated maximum pressure strategy on Tehran. It seems counterintuitive.
Why is this crucial funding being held up? What's the bottleneck?
Well, the funding freeze began back in January as part of a broad pause on foreign assistance generally. But even after that general halt was lifted, solicitations for Iran-based projects, which provide vital censorship circumvention tools to millions of Iranians, have not been issued by the State Department.
And if the funding isn't allocated soon?
If this funding isn't allocated by the end of September, the end of the fiscal year, it will be returned to the Treasury. That threatens the shutdown of vital services like Net Freedom Pioneer's Tusha program.
What does Tusha do?
It transmits uncensored content news, educational material, to 3 million Iranians via satellite file casting, bypassing internet blocks entirely.
3 million people. That's significant. Can you paint a picture of how severe internet censorship is in Iran? Why are these tools so needed?
Iran heavily censors the internet. They block news sites, popular social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter, human rights information, along with thousands of other websites and services. The government also implements internet blackouts during times of crisis and is actively developing a national internet, essentially a walled-off intranet, to further control information flow.
Wow.
Demand for VPNs, virtual private networks, the main circumvention method spikes dramatically during periods of unrest, like the recent Israeli strikes on Iran or the 2022 women-led uprising. Access to uncensored information is truly a lifeline for many.
This sounds like internal dysfunction might be at play within the State Department, possibly overriding stated policy goals or bipartisan consensus.
That's precisely the allegation coming from multiple sources within and outside the government. The issue stems from alleged dysfunction and mismanagement within the State Department. Specifically, Mora Namdar, a political appointee and the acting head of the Near Eastern Affairs, or NEA, Bureau, is accused of personally delaying funding.
Personally delaying it? Why?
For what one source described as political purity tests. She's even accused of ordering memos coming from the team in Dubai to be rewritten to portray a more pessimistic view of the Iranian government's prospects for survival.
Rewriting memos. That sounds like political interference and analysis.
That's the accusation. And this seems profoundly inconsistent with the administration's stated goals regarding internet freedom in Iran.
How so?
Well, this current situation contrasts sharply with the president's own past criticism of Iran for cutting internet services during protests. And Secretary of State Marco Rubio has been very vocal supporting open internet access in Cuba. Namdar herself, despite her past writing supporting maximum pressure and maximum support for the Iranian people, is now somehow at the center of this controversy, holding up the funds. This is happening even as she's been nominated for Assistant Secretary for Consular Affairs.
So the person allegedly blocking the funds is up for promotion.
That appears to be the situation. The critical insight here is that internal bureaucratic dysfunction and potentially political actions by appointees within the State Department seem to be inadvertently undermining long-standing bipartisan U.S. policy aimed at promoting internet freedom in Iran. This effectively aids government censorship and threatens the flow of vital information to millions, especially during periods of intense unrest when it's needed most.
It's a critical look at the sort of hidden mechanisms behind foreign policy execution. From geopolitical struggles to the evolving digital landscape, our next section delves into how technology is reshaping society and culture,
okay,
impacting everything from jobs to social norms. Let's start with the future of work. AI, and the surprising resilience of historians. This one caught my eye.
This is a fascinating story, yeah. It really cuts through some of the hype surrounding artificial intelligence, or AI. A recent Microsoft study ranked historians as the number two job most at risk of being replaced by AI.
Number two. Above almost everything else, that sent shockwaves through the academic world, I imagine. Who is number one?
Interpreters and translators topped the list. But yes, historians at number two was definitely a surprise.
That's quite a claim for a profession like history, which feels so deeply human, so reliant on interpretation and context. How are historians themselves reacting to this? Are they worried?
They are largely skeptical, to put it mildly, and quite vocal about it. Sarah Weichsel of the American Historical Association called the idea simply absurd.
Absurd.
Yes, describing it as a fundamental misunderstanding of what historians do. They argue that while AI will certainly change how they work, maybe speeding up research into massive document collections, for example, it absolutely cannot replace expertise, critical thinking, and the nuanced interpretation of the past. That human element of judgment and synthesis, they contend, is irreplaceable.
That's a powerful counterargument. And it sounds like history graduates have perhaps surprised some people over the years with their career paths, maybe defying stereotypes about humanities degrees.
They certainly have. Despite decades of, let's say, doubts about the practical utility of humanities degrees, history graduates currently have a lower unemployment rate at 4.6% than computer science grads at 6.1%.
Lower than computer science, really?
According to this data, yes. And they find jobs in surprising places, including the National Security Agency, intelligence analysis, policy think tanks, museums, archives, and even, apparently, the American Girl doll company, showing the versatility of their analytical and research skills.
So even Microsoft itself seems to have offered some nuance to its initial, maybe alarming, findings.
Yes. Microsoft later clarified its position. They stated that their data do not suggest that AI will replace these jobs or even that chatbots can fully perform any single occupation. They acknowledge that large language models aren't always suited for every task a job entails.
Right. Nuance is key.
It is. The core insight here, really driven by the historian's perspective, is that while AI will undoubtedly transform various laptop jockey professions by automating certain tasks, human expertise, critical thinking, and nuanced judgment remain irreplaceable. This suggests that the focus should shift from fearing job replacement to understanding how to leverage AI as a powerful tool to enhance human capabilities, not eliminate them.
That's a much more constructive and probably realistic take on the AI conversation. Speaking of technology, though, the race for dominance in space and AI is creating new tensions and legal battles.
Very much so.
Let's talk about SpaceX and the crowding of Cape Canaveral. Sounds like a bottleneck issue.
This is a high-stakes space race brewing right there on America's historic space coast. Elon Musk's SpaceX is requesting permission to launch as many as 76 Starship rockets per year from Cape Canaveral.
76 Starship launches per year from the Cape.
Yes. And that's raising serious alarms among rivals who fear being completely crowded out of this crucial national asset.
76 launches a year for just one company sounds like an unprecedented level of activity. What are the potential implications for competitors and the broader space industry down there?
Well, if approved, this would actually allow SpaceX a total of 120 launches per year from the Cape because they also control another nearby launch pad.
120 launches. Basically one every 3 days.
Almost. Competitors like ULA United Launch Alliance, that joint venture of Lockheed Martin and Boeing, warn this could be catastrophic for their operations. They fear it could create a near complete shutdown of neighboring launch pads almost daily due to safety exclusion zones and logistical conflicts, effectively granting SpaceX a monopolistic position over access to space from the East Coast.
That sounds like a legitimate concern for competition. What's SpaceX's track record with Starship itself, given the ambitious scale of these plans? Is it ready for this kind of operational tempo?
That's a key question. Despite its ambitious scale and potentially revolutionary design, Starship has a mixed safety record from its 9 test flights so far. A 2023 flight, remember, damaged its South Texas launch pad and scattered debris. And a flight just this past March broke apart midair, causing significant FAA delays and reviews.
Right, I remember the debris issues. Any other concerns?
Yes. Further concerns include the Starship's sonic boom, which is estimated to be 10 times louder than its predecessors, like the Falcon 9. There are worries about its potential impact on local wildlife and even structures on the ground.
10 times louder. So there are significant regulatory and environmental challenges here, not just competitive ones.
Indeed. The Space Force and the FAA are currently conducting environmental reviews. While the Space Force report apparently estimated no significant impact structurally from the launches, it does require SpaceX to carry insurance for noise-induced vibrations caused by those powerful sonic booms.
Insurance for vibrations.
Oh.
Okay.
The core insight from the situation is that SpaceX's aggressive expansion plans at Cape Canaveral highlight the intense competition in the rapidly growing commercial space industry. But they also reveal the significant regulatory and environmental challenges of managing a national asset like the Space Coast, forcing authorities to balance fostering innovation against ensuring fair competition, public safety, and environmental protection.
Those are crucial questions for the future of space exploration and commerce. And this ambition for dominance extends to the digital frontier as well, where Elon Musk is also challenging established tech giants, this time in court.
Yes.
Let's discuss Elon Musk's xAI suing Apple and OpenAI. This sounds like a major legal battle.
It is shaping up to be a high-stakes AI antitrust battle that could potentially reshape the tech landscape. Elon Musk's artificial intelligence company, xAI, has sued both Apple and OpenAI,
What's the accusation?
accusing them of colluding to disadvantage his Grok chatbot and effectively lock up markets for AI services, alleging billions of dollars in damages.
Colluding to disadvantage Grok. What are the specifics of xAI's claims against these two tech giants? How did they allegedly collude?
xAI claims Apple is leveraging its App Store, the primary gateway for iPhone users, to get software to suppress Grok's distribution
Suppress it how?
by making it harder to find or perhaps favoring competitors. This, they argue, is done primarily to benefit OpenAI, with whom Apple recently partnered to integrate AI technology like ChatGPT features into its devices.
Okay, so Apple favoring its partner, OpenAI, over Musk's Grok.
That's the claim. And this lawsuit extends Musk's sort of year-long legal campaign against OpenAI, a company he actually co-founded, remember?
Right, he was an early founder.
But he's become increasingly critical of its shift from a nonprofit research lab to a for-profit company, especially after OpenAI's ChatGPT emerged as a frontrunner in the AI race.
Is Apple's deal with OpenAI an exclusive one? Because that would strengthen xAI's claims of collusion if it was.
That's a good point. While Apple's deal with OpenAI isn't strictly exclusive, Apple is reportedly also in talks with Google to integrate its Gemini AI. ChatGPT remains the number one free app in both Apple's iOS App Store and the Google Play Store. It has huge visibility.
Okay, so not exclusive, but dominant. What about Grok's position?
Grok, while definitely lower ranked than ChatGPT, is still a significant player. It's one of only three AI chatbot apps to have hit the top spot on the US Apple App Store in the past year, which indicates it has competitive potential that xAI argues is being stifled.
It's also worth noting some of the ethical considerations that have recently come up with Grok itself, isn't it? Separate from the lawsuit.
Yes, that's true. This legal battle also follows xAI's temporary pause of Grok functions just last month after it generated some unintended and frankly quite disturbing anti-Semitic posts on X, the platform formerly known as Twitter, which Musk also owns. The company stated it later fixed the issue.
Right, so a complex picture.
Very. The critical insight from this lawsuit is that Elon Musk's xAI lawsuit against Apple and OpenAI signals a high-stakes legal and ethical battle that could fundamentally redefine competition and antitrust regulation in the rapidly evolving AI industry. It challenges the power of major tech platforms like app stores and raises crucial questions about market access, innovation fairness, and responsible AI development.
These tech battles are certainly impacting the high-tech world, but sometimes it's the human stories behind the daily grind that remind us of more fundamental challenges in our society.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about the Burger King worker who went viral and was fired. This feels like a real microcosm of broader labor challenges.
This story truly resonated deeply online, didn't it? It sparked widespread public discussion and outrage. Nakia Hamilton, a 25-year-old single mother of three, gained viral fame after a customer posted a TikTok video.
I think I saw that video. It showed her running the whole place alone.
Exactly. Running a short-staffed Burger King completely by herself during a dinner rush, handling the drive-thru, the counter, cooking, everything. Just incredible dedication.
And then she was fired.
Tragically, yes. She was subsequently fired for being late, which was reported as a direct consequence of her ongoing struggles to secure consistent and affordable childcare.
That's an incredibly harsh outcome, especially after her dedication went viral like that. What was the public reaction to her firing?
Her story sparked immense outrage, as you can imagine, and a huge wave of support. Over $125,000 in GoFundMe donations poured in.
Wow. $125,000?
Yes, which she plans to use for her children, rent, and most notably, starting her own cleaning business so she can be her own boss and finally control her schedule.
Good for her. What did Burger King say?
Burger King corporate confirmed her termination was due to repeated attendance issues, citing policy. But they also acknowledged that their own policy requiring multiple employees per shift wasn't followed in her case. They specifically stated no team member should ever be left to run a restaurant alone, even for a short period of time, confirming the understaffing that led to the viral video in the first place.
So they admit the understaffing, but fired her for lateness caused by childcare issues. This incident seems to highlight much larger societal issues beyond just one individual's job, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. This incident underscores the immense burden of balancing caregiving and work, a challenge that disproportionately affects women, particularly women of color. It has, in fact, led many, especially Black women aged 25 to 34, to leave the labor force entirely.
And restaurant workers faced particular challenges.
Yes. Restaurant workers who are often underemployed to begin with face unpredictable schedules, last-minute changes, and lack control over their work hours. This leads to chronic stress, financial instability, and immense difficulties arranging reliable childcare.
And what about the fast food franchise model itself? Does that play a role in this systemic issue? Is it incentivizing these conditions?
Experts quoted in the sources highlight a dysfunctional aspect of the fast food franchise model. You have the big brands dictating most operations, food quality, branding, etc. But they often leave staffing levels and pay decisions entirely to the individual franchise owners.
Ah, creating pressure on the franchisee.
Right. This structure can incentivize the exploitation of workers by pushing for lean staffing to maximize profits for the owner. Nakia Hamilton's story offers a poignant look into the havoc these unstable schedules wreak on personal lives, sometimes even leading, tragically, to children being left unattended because a parent has no other choice. The core insight here is that Nakia Hamilton's viral story powerfully illustrates the systemic labor challenges faced by single parents, especially women, in low-wage industries. It exposes how unpredictable work schedules and the profit-driven franchise model exacerbate issues of childcare access and economic precarity, while social media simultaneously acts as a vital amplifier for these often overlooked struggles.
It's a powerful reminder of the struggles many face just trying to balance work and family. And this story of an individual struggling within a system leads us to consider broader community challenges, like those faced by rural public radio stations fighting for relevance and funding.
This is a critical issue for local communities, yeah, particularly in politically polarized areas where local news sources are already dwindling. Rural public radio stations like KSJD and Montezuma County, Colorado, are facing significant budget cuts.
How significant?
Up to 30% of their funding. This is due to a White House-requested congressional rescission that's basically an act canceling previously appropriated funding of $1.1 billion intended for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, or CPB.
Okay, so CPB funding is being cut, affecting local stations.
Yes, CPB funnels federal funds to National Public Radio, NPR, and Public Broadcasting Service, PBS, affiliates across the country, especially smaller rural ones that rely heavily on it.
And Montezuma County, where KSJD is located, is a deeply conservative area, right?
Yeah.
That must add another layer of complexity to their mission, being an NPR affiliate there.
Exactly. KSJD serves a deeply conservative area. It voted overwhelmingly for President Trump in 2016, 2020, and 2024. Yet, its affiliation with NPR, which is a frequent target of Republican criticism for perceived liberal bias, has made it incredibly difficult to engage conservative listeners and, importantly, local sponsors.
So they're caught in the middle.
Very much so. The station's executive director, Tom Yoder, noted, with a sad laugh apparently, that conservatives think we're the devil.
So these funding cuts, could have a profound impact on their programming and their ability to serve their full community, not just the existing NPR listeners.
They absolutely will. The cuts will likely force these stations to prioritize their existing, generally NPR-loving listeners just to survive financially. This could, paradoxically, cause them to lean further left in their programming choices rather than reaching beyond their comfort zone to engage new, more conservative audiences.
And what does that mean for local news?
It directly impacts local news coverage. KSJD's part-time reporter position is now in jeopardy. Its weekly Spanish news translation has already been axed due to budget constraints. We read about a board discussion at KSJD where they even considered swapping popular NPR shows for BBC programming because of perceived anti-Trump bias in NPR content.
Swapping NPR for the BBC.
They considered it, but ultimately rejected it to maintain the slots for local news and keep their loyal listeners happy. It shows the tough choices they face. Even Bob Bragg's Farm News and Views, a decades-old segment focused on agriculture, now primarily reaches non-farmers, highlighting the struggle to connect with the core agricultural community they're meant to serve.
Despite these challenges, is there any positive sign from the community itself? Are people supporting the station?
There is a silver lining. Despite the challenges, KSJD's faithful listeners have reacted with, as the article puts it, vigor and vehemence. They've doubled donations recently and sent encouraging notes, some explicitly saying things like, because of what Trump did, demonstrating strong local support for the station despite the national political winds.
That's heartening.
It is. The core insight here, though, is that White House-initiated budget cuts to public broadcasting are forcing rural NPR affiliates in politically polarized areas into difficult positions. They have to prioritize existing listeners, potentially inadvertently widening local information divides and challenging their ability to provide comprehensive local news and adopt an all-embracing approach to truly serve their diverse communities, even as loyal listeners rally in support.
That's a crucial point about the potential unintended consequences of such policies on local information ecosystems. From cultural divides to generational gaps, our style section offers a unique look into contemporary life.
Okay, shifting gears.
Let's jump into some of these fascinating cultural currents, from memoirs to memes, starting with Epstein Accuser's memoir To Be Released. This sounds significant.
This is a significant publication, yes. It will undoubtedly reignite public discussion about a very sensitive and important topic. Virginia Roberts Gifford's posthumous memoir titled Nobody's Girl, a memoir of surviving abuse and fighting for justice, is set to be released on October 21st.
For those who might not recall the details, can you remind us of Jeffrey's role in the Jeffrey Epstein scandal?
Jeffrey was one of Jeffrey Epstein's most prominent and outspoken accusers. Over years of lawsuits and interviews, she described how she was ensnared in his sex trafficking ring as a minor, alleging she was abused and passed around like a platter of fruit among powerful individuals associated with Epstein.
And this memoir was completed before her death?
Yes, the memoir itself was completed 4 years before her death this past April. It's also worth noting, contextually, that while President Trump recently claimed Jeffrey had no complaints about us, Knopf, the publisher, has confirmed that no allegations of abuse against Trump are made in the book itself.
Okay, that clarification is important.
It is. The insight here is that the posthumous release of Virginia Roberts Jeffrey's memoir ensures that public scrutiny of Jeffrey Epstein's network and the powerful figures involved will continue. It underscores the enduring quest for accountability and justice for victims of abuse, ensuring their stories are heard even years after the fact.
It certainly will keep that difficult but necessary conversation going. Next, we have a very different cultural phenomenon that's apparently causing quite an uproar. Clock it. We're all finger-clapping wrong. What is this about?
This highlights a classic case of cultural appropriation playing out in the fast-paced world of social media and reality TV. The popular gesture of finger clapping is causing an uproar within the queer ballroom community, which pioneered the gesture decades ago.
Finger clapping, like snapping.
Sort of, but distinct. And the issue is that many mainstream users are simply unaware of its origins, its true meaning within that culture, or even its proper execution. They're doing it wrong and using it out of context.
Can you tell us more about the origins of finger clapping within the ballroom community? Why did it start?
Queer Black and Brown Americans started the ballroom scene as an underground subculture back in 1960s New York. It was partly a response to discrimination they faced in predominantly white drag pageant scenes. Over time, finger claps became a silent, discreet way to show appreciation or applause for performers, especially when traditional clapping was difficult. Maybe you had a cocktail or a fan in one hand.
So, a silent affirmation. How is it properly done?
It's typically done by silently tapping the middle finger against the thumb. The emphasis is on the silence and the specific fingers used.
Okay, so how has this gesture become so widespread now, and why is the ballroom community upset about it?
The gesture's surging popularity is partly attributed to stars of the reality show Love Island USA. They often combine it with other ballroom-derived slang, like clock it, which means did you notice that, or get a load of this, and tea meaning gossip. But they often use the terms and the gesture nonsensically or incorrectly.
Just throwing terms around without understanding.
Exactly. This has led to widespread TikTok debates on the proper way to finger clap. People are now doing it loudly, with their index fingers missing the point entirely. And it's caused immense frustration from ballroom icons like Deshaun Wesley, the MC from the show Legendary, who lament that they took this from the ballroom girls. They feel their culture is being watered down and misused.
Yeah, I can see the frustration.
The core insight here is that the widespread misapplication and misunderstanding of finger clapping on social media exemplifies cultural appropriation. It highlights the responsibility of popular culture and influencers to acknowledge and respect the origins of cultural expressions, especially those from marginalized communities like the ballroom scene, particularly as their rights, like transgender rights, face ongoing societal challenges and rollbacks.
That's a really important cultural dialogue happening there. Shifting gears now to music, we're celebrating an artist who's apparently defying expectations. Passionate Ones is no sophomore slump.
That's right. Baltimore singer-songwriter Marcus Brown, who performs under the name Nourished by Time, has released his sophomore album, The Passionate Ones. And critics agree it absolutely defies the typical sophomore slump with its broad-minded songs and truly unique, captivating sound.
What makes this album stand out, particularly his vocal style and lyrical approach? What's unique?
The album is being praised for its strangely exhilarating exploration of complex themes, love, longing, hard times, and end times. And it's all delivered in Brown's unique low vocal tone.
Low tones? How so?
It's reminiscent of classic R&B singers like Luther Vandross or maybe Yodeci. But instead of soaring into a falsetto, he opts for depth and exploration within that lower register. As one reviewer put it, he stays grounded, more interested in exploring the topography of the music than kissing the clouds.
Interesting description. And the lyrics?
His lyrics are incredibly powerful and often quite audacious. You hear declarations like, "If I'm gonna go insane, at least I'm loved by you," from the track Max Potential. And moments of cold-eyed prescience, like imagining war machines rolling through Baltimore and drawing comparisons to Palestine in his song Baby Baby. The recurring message seems to be a powerful one for our times. We don't have to be so average.
We don't have to be so average. I like that.
The insight here is that Nourished by Time's The Passionate Ones demonstrates how contemporary R&B music can transcend genre boundaries. It delivers deeply personal yet politically resonant commentary through unique vocal artistry and audacious lyricism, proving that artistic innovation can simultaneously be a commercial success and a profound cultural statement.
It's always great to see artists making such a profound impact like that. Now, for something a little lighter, perhaps, but still touching on those interesting generational divides. Nieces prefer cash gifts and don't send thank you notes. This sounds familiar.
This is a classic dilemma, isn't it? Carolyn Hacks addresses it in her advice column, and it's a situation many people listening can probably relate to. It features an aunt who is bewildered, maybe a little hurt, that her teenage nieces consistently prefer cash gifts and equally consistently fail to send thank you notes.
Oh, yeah. I think many people, aunts, uncles, grandparents, can relate to that frustration. What's the aunt's specific perspective on this generational shift in gift giving and gratitude?
The aunt feels that just sending checks is impersonal, like paying bills. And she's deeply frustrated by the complete lack of acknowledgement afterwards. No note, no call, nothing. She contrasts it sharply with her own upbringing, where thank you notes, or at least a phone call, were standard etiquette, basic manners.
Right, the expectation was different.
She also worries that if she stops sending cash and reverts to gift cards or physical presents, the nieces will notice the downgrade, maybe complain to their parents, and then she'll be seen as the difficult one, creating a larger family issue. It's awkward.
It is awkward. And how does Carolyn Hacks, the advice columnist, weigh in on this widespread generational gap? Does she side with the aunt?
Hacks validates that this is a widespread generational gap. She notes that in an era of abundant stuff where young people can often buy what they want online instantly, physical gifts can sometimes feel impersonal or even dismissive to younger recipients.
Dismissive? Interesting take.
Yeah, like the giver didn't really think about what they might actually want or need. She humorously acknowledges the aunt's hope for gratitude, saying, "Hoping for thank you notes, you're adorable."
Bridget.
But she also points out, more seriously, that the nieces owed you proof of life, at the very least. Mm. A text, an email, just some basic acknowledgement that the gift arrived and was received. The underlying issue, Hacks suggests, is maybe that technology and consumerism have called aunties bluffs, revealing a gap between a stated desire to care by giving a gift and the actual commitment to deeper, more regular connection and communication. She suggests maybe the real gift is connection, not just cash.
What's a deeper point?
The insight here is that evolving social etiquette and family relationships in the digital age reveal a significant generational divide in expectations around gift giving and gratitude. While traditional forms like handwritten thank you notes may diminish, the fundamental human need for meaningful connection and acknowledgement remains, challenging families to adapt their communication styles to bridge these gaps.
It's definitely a question many families grapple with, how to show you care across generations. For our next cultural current, we're diving into literature with Fonseca imagines Penelope Fitzgerald at a pivotal moment. Who is Penelope Fitzgerald?
Jessica Frances Cain's new novel, Fonseca, is described as a beautiful literary homage. It pays tribute to the beloved late British writer Penelope Fitzgerald. She's known for novels like The Bookshop and her Booker Prize winner, Offshore.
Okay. And what does this new novel, Fonseca, do?
It reimagines a real trip Fitzgerald took to Mexico back in 1952 with her son. They went there hoping to claim an inheritance that they desperately needed.
What aspect of Fitzgerald's life and work does Cain's novel explore, particularly in relation to her artistic journey? She started writing late, didn't she?
Yes, exactly. The novel delves into Fitzgerald's life during a period when she struggled financially after her husband's difficult return from military service and subsequent alcoholism. She eventually published her first acclaimed novel at the age of 60.
60, wow.
Cain's novel faithfully echoes Fitzgerald's known interests and her own writing style, her dry wit, her focus on eccentric characters, her sort of understated prose. However, some critics note that while it's a loving tribute, it sometimes lacks Fitzgerald's own unique, almost uncanny ability to transfigure ordinary events into something truly otherworldly and profound in her own fiction.
So a good homage, but maybe not quite capturing the original magic.
Perhaps. But it still sounds like it offers a unique and valuable perspective on her journey as a writer and a woman.
How so?
Well, Fonseca apparently succeeds in evoking an unorthodox heroine, someone who is simultaneously a devoted mother putting her artistic goals on hold and a dogged, determined writer underneath. It offers what one review called a refreshingly guilt-free entry in the literature of working moms.
Guilt-free. That's interesting.
Yes, exploring how Fitzgerald's gradual acceptance of a difficult, uncertain future, rather than pinning her hopes on some miraculous windfall like the Mexican inheritance, ultimately allowed her to finally put pen to paper and embrace her writing career late in life. The insight here is that Jessica Frances Cain's Fonseca offers a compelling exploration of the creative process and the complex choices artists make, particularly for women balancing family and ambition. By reimagining a pivotal moment in Penelope Fitzgerald's life, it highlights how the acceptance of reality, even a difficult one, can sometimes be the key that unlocks artistic potential.
That's a powerful narrative about resilience and creativity. Finally, in the world of gaming, we have creator of Smash Bros. Wants Kirby to fly even higher. Sounds fun.
This is exciting news for gamers, yes, especially fans of classic Nintendo characters. Masahiro Sakurai, the acclaimed creator of Kirby and the incredibly popular Super Smash Bros. Series, is set to release a new game called Kirby Air Riders for the upcoming Switch 2 console.
Kirby Air Riders? Isn't that a GameCube game?
It was. This seems to be a sequel or reimagining. It promises a fast-paced vehicle action game that looks incredibly innovative based on the descriptions.
Sakurai is known for his specific game design principles, often emphasizing simplicity and accessibility, right? How does this new game align with or perhaps challenge that philosophy?
That's a good question. Sakurai is known for emphasizing simplicity, often using minimal buttons. But here, he has actually added a dedicated special button to the new game. It's a design choice he acknowledges goes against his usual approach.
Why add it then?
He states it adds significant load to the chaos and fun. The game's basic air ride mode is a simple racing mode, true to his philosophy. But the addition of special abilities and attack combinations makes it much faster and more explosive, pushing the boundaries of traditional Kirby gameplay.
Okay, so added complexity for more fun. What's the standout feature of this new Kirby game that gamers should be most excited about?
The centerpiece is undoubtedly the City Trial Mode. This allows up to 16 players to drop into a single, expansive map filled with natural and urban environments.
16 players. In a Kirby game.
16 players. The goal is to spend about 5 minutes exploring, collecting power-ups, and essentially building a customized rider machine. Think of it like a souped-up hovercraft. Then players take their custom machines and compete in various randomly selected minigames, drag races, battle arenas, gliding competitions, things like that.
That sounds chaotic and fun, like Mario Kart meets a build-your-own-vehicle game.
Exactly. It offers potentially a different and deeper experience than Mario Kart, according to the preview. With blazing fast speed and stunning visuals promised for the Switch 2, they even mention levels like an Old Testament-style parting sea.
Wow. Okay.
The insight here is that legendary game designer Masahiro Sakurai continues to push boundaries with Kirby Air Riders. He's blending his core philosophy of simplicity with innovative mechanics and large-scale multiplayer chaos, demonstrating how game design can evolve to create fresh, dynamic experiences on new hardware platforms like the Switch 2.
That's a great look into the future of gaming. And now, moving from digital entertainment to live action, our final section dives into the world of sports with all its drama, triumphs, and challenges.
All right, let's get into it.
Starting with the Washington Commanders, securing their star wide receiver Terry McLaurin, but facing the age 30 question that always looms over productive stars in the NFL.
This was big news for Washington fans, yeah. Definitely a sigh of relief for the franchise. The Commanders and Terry McLaurin agreed to a 3-year, $96 million contract extension.
$96 million over 3 years. Wow!
Yeah, it finally ended months of pretty contentious negotiations, including a holdout and trade request, just weeks before what's being called their most anticipated season in decades, largely thanks to their new quarterback.
That's a significant financial commitment. What does this deal mean for McLaurin and the team, especially with that new quarterback, Jaden Daniels, at the helm?
Well, the deal makes McLaurin one of the NFL's highest-paid wideouts, about $32 million average annual value. And critically, it ensures that rookie quarterback Jaden Daniels has his favorite and most reliable target locked up.
That connection is key for a rookie QB.
Absolutely. And McLaurin, who turns 30 this September, has demonstrated exceptional durability and professionalism throughout his career. He's played in 101 out of 104 possible games and consistently put up 1,000-yard seasons despite having really erratic quarterback play for most of his time in Washington.
His performance has been incredibly consistent despite the circumstances. What about the specifics of the deal and that age 30 question? Wide receivers often see a drop-off around that age.
That's the big question mark, always. McLaurin's impressive 2024 season, he had a career-high 13 touchdowns and made key plays in their playoff run, certainly strengthens his case that he can defy the typical age 30 decline. He's known for meticulous body care.
Right, some guys manage it.
But the key unknown, which wasn't immediately reported, is the amount of guaranteed money in the contract. That's crucial for fully evaluating the deal's true financial impact and the risk the team is taking. Can he maintain peak production into his early 30s? Or will this contract become a financial burden later, especially as they plan for Daniels' future extension down the road? The core insight here is that the Commanders' substantial investment in Terry McLaurin represents a high-stakes bet on a veteran star to defy the typical age-related decline at a demanding position. The long-term success of this deal hinges on his exceptional durability continuing and the team's ability to build effectively around both him and their promising new franchise quarterback.
It's definitely a high-stakes bet on a proven professional player. While the Commanders aim for a turnaround with their new QB and secured receiver, another local team is grappling with what's being called a nightmarish season.
Oh.
Let's look at the Baltimore Orioles. After the O's fell off, can they climb back up?
Yeah, the Orioles are indeed having what's widely described as a nightmarish season, just a catastrophic performance, really, marked by a combination of maybe predictable pitching depth issues, but also numerous injuries to key players in a completely unpredictable team-wide slump that almost no one saw coming after their recent success.
What were some of the key factors contributing to this disastrous season for a team that had such high hopes coming into the year?
It really was a perfect storm of bad luck and maybe some missteps. Key players, like their young ace pitcher Grayson Rodriguez, never even pitched this season due to injury. Veteran starter Zach Eflin needed season-ending back surgery. And stars like catcher Adley Rutschman, outfielder Colton Cowser, and closer Felix Bautista all suffered multiple injuries throughout the season, limiting their effectiveness or keeping them off the field entirely.
Just decimated by injuries.
Yes, it led to a significant attrition rate. And as Rutschman himself put it, the team simply didn't play our brand of baseball. General manager Mike Elias admits the organization could have, would have, should have done better, acknowledging deficiencies in pitching depth and the relative ineffectiveness of some of their free agent signings this past offseason. Rutschman himself, the cornerstone catcher, is now facing durability questions and has seen a noticeable decline in his offensive numbers this year.
So a perfect storm of bad luck, injuries, and maybe some strategic missteps.
Mm-hmm.
What's the outlook for next season? How do they plan to rebound from this nightmare?
Well, the team's relatively new owner, David Rubenstein, expresses hope for a healthier next year and mentions other projects underway, which vaguely hints at potential new acquisitions or different development strategies.
Okay, so hope springs eternal.
As always in baseball, the big question is whether the Orioles can actually bounce back. Will they rely mainly on the return to health of existing players? Or will the arrival of a new wave of highly touted prospects, names like Samuel Basalo, Jackson Holliday, Kobe Mayo, be enough to turn things around quickly? Or will this season's deep dive into underperformance linger psychologically and make the climb back up even more challenging? The core insight here is that the Baltimore Orioles' nightmarish season highlights the profound impact of injuries and pitching depth deficiencies on even a talented and promising team. It underscores that a successful rebuild, or sustaining success, requires not just acquiring talent, but also robust player health management and effective midseason adjustments to maintain competitive performance year after year.
It's going to be a fascinating rebuilding, or perhaps retooling, effort to watch in Baltimore. Meanwhile, another local team, the Washington Nationals, is struggling with fundamental errors that are clearly derailing their season.
Seems to be a theme locally.
It does. Let's talk about the Nats. Fundamental mistakes doom Nats and a sloppy loss in the Bronx.
Yes. The Washington Nationals suffered a pretty ugly, sloppy 10-5 loss to the New York Yankees. The game was reportedly plagued by fundamental mistakes, particularly on the bases, that truly confounded their offense and basically took them out of the game early.
What kind of errors are we talking about here, specifically? Base running mistakes?
Exactly. Key errors included first baseman Josh Bell being caught stealing second base at a critical moment, and just a general inability to execute basic base running plays effectively. This is despite the team having an aggressive identity on the base paths. They actually add an MLB high number of stolen bases in 2024.
High stolen bases, but costly mistakes.
Right. They also had a high caught stealing rate, indicating a lack of efficiency and maybe poor decision making. Their current base running runs metric, which tries to quantify the value of base running, places them a disappointing 18th in MLB, middle of the pack at best.
And it wasn't just base running in this game.
No, the pitching also struggled. Starter Brad Lord gave up a career-high 7 runs, and reliever Cole Henry allowed a 3-run homer later on. Manager Dave Martinez, the article mentions manager Cairo, maybe an interim. Anyway, the manager emphasized afterwards, to beat teams like this, the Yankees, you cannot give outs away. Highlighting the cost of these errors, the feeling is the team's rebuild has flatlined, partly due to these unforced fundamental errors.
So the rebuild is stalling.
That's the concern. The core insight here is that the Washington Nationals season is being undermined by persistent fundamental errors, particularly in base running. This demonstrates that even aggressive strategies can backfire without precise execution and highlights how a lack of attention to the little things in baseball can stagnate a team's rebuilding efforts and cost them winnable games against better opponents.
It's always about execution, especially for a young rebuilding team. Amidst these team struggles, however, a very young star is shining brightly as his professional career begins for the Nationals.
Ah, some positive news.
Yes. Let's hear about Willits, 17, who shows poise and promise as his pro career gets underway.
This is a truly impressive and inspiring story, yes. Eli Willits, the 17-year-old number one overall pick in the 2025 MLB draft by the Nationals, is already demonstrating remarkable poise and promise as his professional career gets underway down in Class A Fredericksburg.
17 years old. Number one pick overall, and already making an impact in professional baseball, surrounded by much older players. How has he started his career statistically?
Willits has had a fast start, according to the report. In his first few games, he was batting 6 for 14, that's over .400 with 3 RBI, 2 walks, and a stolen base. He's notably the youngest true prospect in this year's draft class, meaning most other high picks were older college players. He's playing against guys years older than him who have been in professional systems for much longer.
That age difference is huge at that level. What are teammates and coaches saying?
His roommate in Fredericksburg, 21-year-old Ethan Petrie, calls him the most polished 17-year-old kid I've ever seen. Petrie recalled a moment where Willits calmly watched a 98-mile-per-hour fastball go by, then laced the next pitch, another fastball, through the infield for a hit. Just cool under pressure.
I know.
Polished and patient.
Yes. The team manager, Billy McMillan, even sees a shared trait with perennial all-star Mookie Betts. An unusual level of patience and pitch recognition for his age.
That's high praise indeed, comparing him to Mookie Betts. How is Willits himself handling the dramatic shift from high school life in Oklahoma just months ago to the intense pressures of professional baseball?
He seems to be navigating this dramatic shift with remarkable external calm. He's reportedly staying connected to his old high school teammates' college stats while fully embracing his new reality. He focuses on having fun, enjoying the game, but internally, he holds himself to incredibly high standards. He told the reporter he tells himself he needs to compete and beat them every day, referring to the older players he's facing.
That's quite a mindset for a 17-year-old. It is. The core insight here is that Eli Willits' exceptional poise and rapid professional start as a 17-year-old number one pick demonstrate the rare combination of raw talent, mental fortitude, and disciplined focus required for prodigies to succeed under the intense pressures of elite professional sports. He offers a tantalizing glimpse into the future potential for the Nationals organization.
A remarkable start to what could be an incredible career to follow. Speaking of young talent making a huge impact, a 16-year-old just made a dramatic debut on the international soccer stage over in England.
Oh, yeah.
This is the story of Liverpool faltering, then prevailing in a classic thanks to a teenager's dream debut.
This sounds like one of those truly memorable matches. Liverpool apparently secured a dramatic 3-2 victory over Newcastle United, who were playing with only 10 men for much of the game. And the winner came from a sensational stoppage time goal scored by a 16-year-old substitute, Riungamoha, making his Premier League debut.
16 years old, scoring the winner in stoppage time in his debut. That sounds like something out of a movie. Can you walk us through the drama of that match?
It was described as a game for the ages. Newcastle had a player sent off early, getting a red card. Liverpool then looked to be cruising, taking a comfortable 2-0 lead. It seemed like the match was over.
Classic setup for drama.
Exactly. But Newcastle, even with 10 men, mounted an incredible comeback, scoring twice to level the scores at 2-2 in the 88th minute. St. James's Park must have been going wild.
Unbelievable comeback. Then what?
Then came the moment of magic. Ngamoha, the 16-year-old academy product, entered the game 6 minutes into added time. Just 4 minutes later, deep into stoppage time, he scored the winning goal. And this was only 4 days before his 17th birthday.
4 days before turning 17. Does that make him one of the youngest scorers ever?
It made him the fourth youngest scorer in Premier League history. An incredible debut. Liverpool's coach, Arne Slot, celebrated the special nature of the Premier League afterwards, acknowledging his team didn't play well enough on the ball, but crucially didn't collapse and stood strong to get the win. The dramatic finish also overshadowed some pregame drama surrounding Newcastle's star striker Alexander Isak apparently demanding a transfer.
Right, the game itself took over.
Completely. The core insight here is that Riungamoha's sensational debut, scoring a dramatic winning goal at just 16 years old in the Premier League, epitomizes the thrilling emergence of young talent in elite global soccer. It highlights how a single moment can transform a player's career trajectory, galvanize a team, and signal the powerful impact a new generation can have on the sport.
Wow, Sam, what an incredible journey through the pages of the Washington Post today. Just so much happening.
It really was.
From the highest offices of power and those Nobel ambitions, down to the diamond factories of India facing tariff impact.
Right, and from the digital battlegrounds of AI lawsuits and space launches to the dramatic fields of sports with teenage heroes and struggling teams, we've seen how interconnected our world truly is.
Indeed. Whether it's the ripple effects of, say, political ambition on international relations and maybe even troop deployments.
Uh-huh. Or the very personal stakes of economic policy, like for Nikea Hamilton or the students facing tuition hikes.
Yeah. or even those cultural currents reshaping how we interact, how we show appreciation, or whose stories get told.
Exactly. Every story, really, offers a window into larger forces at play. It highlights how individual actions, corporate decisions, grand policies, they all intertwine constantly to create our collective reality.
You know, for me, thinking back on everything we covered, what really stands out today is that constant push and pull, that tension between individual rights and collective authority, or maybe corporate power or governmental power.
That's a strong theme.
You see it in the debate over cashless bail versus federal mandates. You see it in the battle for internet freedom in Iran against state control. You even see it in a different way, in the discussion about the origins of a simple finger clap who owns culture.
That's true, the ownership and control theme.
It feels like it's all about who holds the power to define what's acceptable, what's just, what's fair, and ultimately what's true in a given situation.
That's a profound point. And if we connect that to the bigger picture, thinking about all the information we just processed from one day's news, it raises an important question, maybe for you, our listener. In a world where information is so abundant, it's everywhere, but it's often filtered, framed, sometimes heavily politicized. How do you discern the difference between a carefully constructed narrative, maybe like the justification for firing a Fed governor or taking a stake in Intel, and the underlying facts? And perhaps even more importantly, what role do you believe individuals have in shaping their own reality, their own understanding, against these powerful currents of information and authority?
A powerful thought to leave us with. How do we navigate it all? Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep digging, keep questioning, and stay well informed.